Okay, so thanks everyone for joining, and thanks again, Federica, for being here and for entering this discussion with us. So what I'm trying to do is maybe a bit similar to what Andrea has done in that I try to link some of the inspiration I got from the book with some examples from my own practice as a philosopher. And the main background for my work is this collaboration with Hans Briegel, who is on the slide here, so the head of the group that Andrea is working in Innsbruck. And we're running a project that is trying to understand the notion of agency via its role in science. And the interest there is that you can think, well, there are exemplary instantiations of agency in various human practices, for example, in creative action in the arts, or where agency is especially highlighted is in moral questions. But there, the philosophical surroundings are a thicket, and it's very hard to pinpoint a notion of agency in those contexts. Whereas in science, I think this is also an exemplary context for human agency, but the philosophical discussion isn't so difficult, so maybe we are able to highlight aspects of agency more easily if we look at science. And so the background for this project is to look at how agency could come up through the ongoing AI revolution in science, where, as Andrea just highlighted, we see that, of course, science is always built on this, or is of a piece with technology, really. So I think most of us are fully on board with what you're explaining very nicely in your book. The question is whether there is a new quality of the interrelation between science and technology in the sense of an enhanced autonomy of the technology that pushes it towards agency. And there I will engage with the notion of agency as you're using it in your book and trying to contrast that a bit with the notion of agency we're trying to flesh out in this project. And I hope this can be beneficial to just learn from what you're doing. And my focus for the talk will be to look at this how agency plays out in science, and if we make a bold claim, then the core expression of agency in science is modeling, I would say. And so I think we have a lot of common ground when it comes to thinking about models, where you detail in the book very nicely a general understanding of models in philosophy of science as it's traditionally conceived, where the primary anchor for modeling is representation. So if you look up the Stanford Encyclopedia entry by Frick and Hartmann, a very, very nice encyclopedia entry, but it starts basically with this idea models are representations. Then there is this, in a way, a turn in the understanding of models through the book by Morgan and Morrison, this idea of models as mediators, where you see that models are placed in a somewhat different context, but there, it's not yet a mediation between an agent and the world or whatever, but it's more the theory data relation where the model comes in as a mediator. And I think we are on board with what you are saying when we try to highlight the role of models as tools in scientific practice and in knowledge production. So what I'm trying to do, and I hope I get through this in time, is two parts, and maybe I only get through the first part in detail, but that may also be enough. One is I very much found resonating with your claim about model validation as a practice. And I've just recently returned from a long stay at a climate modeling group at Caltech in Pasadena, and I will just want to relate a few experiences from trying to understand climate modeling and trying to understand the assessment of what a good or a valid or whatever, skillful, as they sometimes say, climate model is. And I think I'm picking up on a theme from your book, or at least I hope, when trying to highlight the notion of trust as really key for climate model validation. And then if I come to it in a substantial way, I'll try to get this contrast of scientific agency versus the for you central notion of epistemic agency on the plate, so that we can discuss about that. And where my claim would be that scientific agents are modelers. And that maybe when you look at scientific agency as modeling and try to model scientific agency as something that can itself be the subject of scientific investigation, you maybe trace out a road towards the establishment of autonomous scientific agents, like the beginnings of which Andrea sketched in her talk. Okay, so model validation in climate science. So I just mentioned I was at this group, the Klima group at Caltech, and they are fairly unique in that they are building a new climate model from scratch. So they're really coding everything fresh. Whereas all the running climate models at the various centers that are doing climate modeling, they mostly operate on a certain basis of legacy code, often dating from, you know, 70s Fortran stuff. And here it's a new initiative, a new group. They're trying to integrate also a workflow where they use data and AI technology at a very early stage and at a very integral stage in the climate modeling. And I found it very interesting to look at climate models as models because they stick out as somewhat recalcitrant cases, I think. On the one hand, the relation of model to theory in climate modeling is peculiar in that I think we cannot, often we think, okay, we have a theory and then we have a model based on the theory and somehow this is our model. Whereas here, climate modeling really picks bits and pieces from all sorts of theories, especially when you think about climate models as Earth system models, which is what you have to do nowadays. So a climate model in the narrow sense would be a global circulation model where you really look at just the atmosphere. It was basically the dynamics of wet air, which is super complicated. I was really flabbergasted at how difficult it is to understand moist air. It's really impossible, basically, because you have these clouds and you have evaporation, you have condensation to whatever, water droplets and ice and everything. It's a mess. So in a way, the theories there take second rank behind the model, I think, because you take the Navier-Stokes equation from fluid dynamics. That's basically your basic tool for atmospheric dynamics. But then you also need ocean dynamics, you need a land model, you need some plant models, you need all sorts of things. And in a way, I think there is a certain, maybe that's a sociological remark, there is a certain understanding that some people in Earth system modeling, not a group I was at, they think of themselves as now entering the top of the food chain in science. So they are using up all the resources, right? So the LHC is up and running, that's okay. They are technologically very expensive, but in terms of computational resources, it's either nuclear weapons research, they are using the big supercomputers, and the other guys who want to use these resources are the Earth system modelers. And there's currently, which I found disturbing and worrisome in a way, there's a current hype where the EU is spending €1 billion on building a digital twin of the Earth system. And I don't know whether some of you have been in contact with that. So the idea there is to disregard everything we have, if we have learned anything from philosophy of science, thinking about models, is that a model is not a copy of a system, unless you're doing Mars rovers at NASA, where they have a copy of the Mars rover as a model. But normally a model is a simplification, is an idealization, is something that is not the system. And they are trying to hype this idea of building a digital twin of the atmosphere and then doing interventions and studies and maybe large-scale technological interventions on the atmosphere based on these digital twins. So there is, I think the interesting question is, suppose Earth system modeling is at the top of the food chain in terms of computational resources, what would a good Earth system model be like? And I think it would not be trying to be a digital twin of the atmosphere. It would be something distinctively different. And the question is what that is. And so, as I said, the Klima Research Group, where I was at, they are trying to build such a new model. And one foil that is often used is that in weather prediction, we are now entering a new age of the uses of AI technology. I mean, maybe you've read the news that NVIDIA's stock market value has exceeded $1 billion or $1 trillion, I think that's the English word. So they are, one of their key applications at the moment for their GPU systems is to run weather prediction on data only. So they are almost there. They just feed lots of satellite images and lots of sensor data. They train a huge model, and then they can predict the weather fairly accurately for these 10 days or whatever. So there is really no theory anymore. And that is strange, because the standard weather models, of course, they use a lot of fluid dynamics and all sorts of atmospheric circulation theory. But in weather prediction, it seems we can really get to this data-only science, right? And just as a side remark, that's where meta-induction really applies, right? So meta-induction is the idea that whoever makes the best predictions wins out. If it's the fool on the hills throwing chicken boats, and they tell you reliably that in 9 days it will be raining in Constance, you go with their prediction, unless, you know, they fail, and then you go with someone else. So that's really interesting. And what people conflate, and I think the digital twin crowd conflate, is that climate looks to be similar to weather. But climate is a really completely different animal from weather, because in weather, you try to extrapolate from a current system state to a future system state. And it is completely well known and understood that given the chaotic dynamics of the atmosphere, you can only do that like 2 weeks ahead. And it will never be possible, in a way, to go much beyond that, because everything washes out over these 2 weeks. So in climate prediction, the initial state doesn't matter at all, because you compute the model for 100 years forward. And you're not interested in the weather 30 years from now, because that is just a random data point. What you're interested in is the statistics of these weather predictions 30 years from now at specific locations, given specific boundary values of emission scenarios or whatever. So it's a really different animal. And still, you can use machine learning in climate prediction to a good extent. And that has to do with the fact that when you do climate modeling, you do that on a grid. So you make a maybe 10 by 10 kilometer grid of the Earth. And then for each grid cell, you have a few values that you compute forward in time over these 30 or 100 years. And of course, you're often interested in subgrid processes, like clouds form not at the scale of 30 kilometers, but at the scale of a few hundred meters. And some of the dynamical processes in clouds happen at the scale of meters only. And some other processes that are important for turbulence happen at yet smaller scales. And crystallization in clouds happens at micrometer scales. So there's a lot of information and important stuff going on at these small levels. And there you can use machine learning. And that's something that is starting. So it's really different from what the weather prediction people do. But it's also a more local use of machine learning to resolve physical processes for which we have no theory, or even if we had the theory, we would never have the computational resources to compute them. And there, I think, what becomes important is what is the cost on the trust you put on your climate model when you apply these machine learning methods that are maybe in themselves intransparent. And I find that is a very interesting dynamics playing out in climate modeling. And so here I think I come to your observations about model validation as an activity and a practice and as not a property of models. So I'm running over time, so let me just display this list of aspects of validity. And give some quotes or a list of aspects of validity that Andrea also more or less had on already. I think that is something that really resonates with me very much, that the validity of a model is in a way being able to generate a coherent story that others will then be able to trust, right? So you need to attend to the usefulness of your model for the users, and you have model validation as a reflective practice. And I think we see this really in climate modeling, where I think it's interesting to shift the focus from the question of, is this the true model? Is this how the Earth system works? Where we know we can never be there, because a lot of things we can never ascertain, we don't have enough data, we will never have enough computation power. And also, what is peculiar in climate science is that something that I wasn't sure, I haven't seen a lot of reflection on this point in the modeling literature. Often you assume that when you have a model, you can test the model by checking its empirical adequacy. That's a key notion. Even if you walk away from the idea of a realistic representational understanding of model, you still think a model has to be empirically validated. And in climate modeling, you can never do that, because you have no climate statistics for 40 years hence. It's just unavailable information. And still, we have, for these very long time scales, high stakes decisions that we want to tell people to base on our modeling, right? And there's a lot of friction there, and understandably so, I think, when we really look at an honest description of what the modeling practice can be and what validation can mean. So if you look at validation playing out in practice in climate science, you see that this huge bureaucracy that has been built up over the last 30 years or so at the IPCC has a lot to say. The workgroup one, the physical sciences workgroup at the IPCC, has a lot to say on which models are taken up into the model ensemble, how they are weighed, which features of models are seen as especially worrisome or as good. You see at the IPCC a move towards vernacular language. Very much they have completely gone away from giving probability values. So they really use these, it's in a way coded probability language, of course, but it's seen to be much more useful to say likely, highly likely, probable, possible, and these gradations. And they often put in an extra sigma by going one step down from what the science tells them, so as an extra layer of uncertainty. And so what I find really interesting playing out in building a new climate model is, how do you establish trust in your new climate model? And I think there's a lot of interesting observations in how do you interact with this climate model, and how does it respond to interventions or to other kinds of counterfactual questions? What kinds of scenarios can you posit and use to check how the model reacts, right? So this, I think, points towards an idea that I have that I can't really fully support, but I mean, a weather app now, you can really interact with a lot, right? You can look, you can in a way query it a bit. You can say, oh, give me the temperature plot for 3 days hence, and it will give you something that you can play around with it a bit. You can go to a nearby location maybe and look at the temperature plot there, and if you have local knowledge, you can see, oh, does it account for the differences in elevation maybe between places I'm interested in. And a climate model could also have such, you know, app-like interaction features to make it more trustworthy. At least that's an idea. And that's how I come very loosely to the second part of my talk, which I will have to rush through, which is how modeling is really this key aspect of scientific agency. So maybe a climate model that is that looks more agent-like could be trusted more when it somehow interacts well with the human user, with the prompter. So here again, I want to stress a common ground that I found reading your book, namely that modeling is really at the core of technoscientific practices. It's really the main thing, working with paper and pencil or tinkering with some, you know, chemical binding model or whatever, or writing computer code, running a simulation. It's really something you can intervene on, you can test, you can check for reactions. And you stress in your book that two things are discussed far too little, namely the role of the modeler, so who builds those models, and the practice of modeling. And what I found very helpful in your book is to see how you stress the notion of a model as a tool that we build and manipulate. And I, with Hans Briegel, we're discussing scientific agency as modeling a lot, and we also come up with this idea that it's really the tool that is, in a way, helping you to probe the world, right? To feel the resistance of the world with the model. And this tool can be, so when Frege says logic is like my microscope, the language, the tweezer of language, in a way, for the microscope, or when we really build a machine to, I don't know, get some chemical reaction going or whatever. So we really have to reject this idea of models as representations. We have to acknowledge that modeling can be manifold. So there is methodological pluralism. But I want to press this question of who really is the agent that models, and what about self-application? Can we model the modeler? And that is something that I find quite interesting. And now I think, in the interest of time, I should really just flash a few ideas and get to an end here. So you stress agency realism. We also try to stress agency realism, but it may be that we mean different things. And there I confess to being a more traditional philosopher of science, and that I'm thinking of the world as primarily physical entities, but organized physical entities. So it's not, I'm not a reductionist. I think there is an ontological difference in having solid state objects, living beings, a society in the world that's not just an arrangement of particles. It's really something new in the world, but I still think we can link this to an integrative understanding of ontology, where these entities are emergent entities. And if that is so, then an agent, like any other emergent entity, will be very difficult to study, but it should be possible to study it. And one foil we're trying to use in our ongoing work for the peg to hang the notion of emergence on is to steer away from life, because life is messy and difficult and everything. We use the sun as our main example of an emergent ontological entity, where the thing is you have in the sun something like autopoiesis, if you want, so some homeostatic processes. You have something like a life cycle of a star, so you have some process that is ongoing. So I think this reflects very nicely your point about process ontology. I think that's exactly to the point. If you think about emergent entities, you have to stress the processual nature of their being. But still, you can model the sun. We have very good physical models of processes in the sun that lead to, you know, the fine balance between gravitational pressure and the fusion processes going on, and when helium would start to burn and everything. So maybe in a similar way, you know, we can look at agency as an emergent feature in our world. And the question, maybe I should almost end here. When you use a fairly lightweight notion of agency, where an epistemic agent can be something as, let's say, passive, you know, as a scientific instrument. And I very much understand that these instruments play an important and in some sense autonomous role in the production of knowledge, because they stabilize phenomena and they have their own materiality and they can surprise us as well in their constitution. We have to learn to use them. When you use a complicated scientific instrument, it takes a lot of practice, a lot of skill to operate it well. But still, there is no agency of a higher type in the scientific instrument. And there I want to make a distinction. And so one publication that I find very helpful in anchoring thinking about agency is Helen Stewart's Metaphysics for Freedom, where she gives a list of aspects of agency that are important, and in work together with Hans Briegel, we've tried to come up with our own understanding of agency that is somehow parallel to what Stewart does, but also deviates. And the important thing is that we stress agency attribution as a main way into a notion of agency. And here's my standard example of attribution, where you see the cat shedding hair is treated as a physical object that interacts causally with the world but cannot be trained as an agent. It just sheds hair. You can put a cat sweater on the cat, or you can vacuum off the hair, but you can't train the cat not to shed hair. But you can train the cat as an agent to not claw your sofa. Well, good luck. But so there is a difference in our relation to these things if we take them to be mere objects or if we take them to be agents. And this is now maybe linking to Andrea's work. The key aspect of agency in this sense, in this more loaded sense, which incorporates animal agency, human agency, maybe artificial agency, but not the mere agency of epistemic agents like scientific instruments, would be learning. And there are different ways learning plays out, and you saw this, I think, in Andrea's discussion of reinforcement learning very nicely, that there are episodes through which, you know, through feedback in interaction with the environment, an agent creates dispositions for behaving in certain ways. And so you have individual learning at the end. And just to show this, there is, I think, an interesting parallel between a discussion of levels of causation that Pearl makes in his interesting Book of Why, and attribution, where you can parallel. So you can say, if I'm really talking about a mere object of reference, like a number, I can say 7 is a prime number. I'm attributing a probability to a mere object of reference. And at that level, I think that is something that Pearl stresses in his book. When you analyze data at that level, you get mere correlation data. When you can do interventions, you have causal attribution, and you are at the level of a physical object. So you can say this pen writes with blue ink or something. But once you get to the notion of counterfactuality, you are, I think, at the notion of agential attribution and at the notion of an agent as an object. And we, human beings, are special in that we can move one rung up. So here is morality. And it's the moral agent to which you can attribute things like wronging someone, which is not there for the cat, but which is there for us. So this slide is too much to explain, but here is a model, a very simplistic model of agency and learning that we are studying together with Hans Briegel and in this group, and which is behind some of the work in the group that Andrea was talking about, where you can think of a very simple learning process building up behavioral dispositions in terms of building up a notion of agency through having a learning history. Okay, and then if my main claim is, you know, scientific agency is modeling, can there be artificial scientific agency? So could really an AI system graduate from being a tool in the sense of an AI assistant, like we heard, for example, also in Sarah's talk, to this third level, which is Sarah's third level, right, of of really a scientific agent. And so as I said, in these cases of artificial agents, when we talk about self-driving cars, we all hear about these trolley cases and ethics. And I think that's really blurring the waters, and it's not very helpful to go there first. And when we look at creativity in the artistic sphere, it's also very interesting and surprising what these systems can do. But again, we import a lot of considerations from difficult parts of philosophy when you discuss this. Whereas here in science, I think we have a more level playing field for understanding the notion of agency. So I think that if we see artificial agents coming up, entering the world and being part of our society anytime soon, they might very well be in science. So to sum up, science as a collaborative endeavor produces distributed knowledge through scientific agency, and modeling is a key tool for scientific agents to produce models, theoretical tools that help these agents to get a handle on what they're interacting with. And I think we need to study what Andrea was hinting at, right? What about the transparency of these models? What about trust? How can we garner trust in these artificial scientific agents? And can they surprise us? When will we start attributing real agency to them? Well, those are questions with which I want to end. Thank you.
Thanks, Thomas. This was so rich that I am not sure I'm going to get my head around and formulate something sensible, because so on the one hand, I find it fascinating that you tried to run these ideas through the climate modeling mm-hmm. part, which I was not able to do because it is so complex as yeah. a field that I did not have the time to go properly into it. But it looks like there is really a lot that we can discuss about modeling from the non-mainstream perspective of mm-hmm. just looking at representation. So mm-hmm. that I find a very interesting area to look at, mm-hmm. Definitely. And I guess it's in between a question and a comment, because towards the end of the first part of your talk, so on the one hand, you have been trying to problematize how much climate modeling requires a different way of looking at what models are and what they mm-hmm. do, including us, et cetera, et cetera. And then towards the end, you had this point that IPCC is moving towards using more vernacular language rather mm-hmm. than just a kind of dry numerical outputs. And so my question is, what do you make out of it? Because I may have an intuition of why this is an important aspect, but I guess I would like to hear from you what is the relevance of this move.
I think you know, climate modeling maybe started out as a curiosity driven thing, as an end in itself, and then the scientists just want to get a good model going, and they are in their little group and they discuss on their own terms. But with the IPCC, you have this larger interface with the public, and you need to be able to communicate. So it becomes important who is the user of the model, because you model for someone. So the usefulness of a model gets transplanted, I think, from outside of the scientific circles, where the usefulness is maybe resolving a certain interesting phenomenon. Say, if my climate model is nice because I can model whatever, the El Niño-Southern Oscillation or whatever. And then your model cannot do that, and then we discuss in these terms. But here I have to interface with a public that requires us to give guidance in a certain way, and there are high-stakes decisions, and these high-stakes decisions are often made on the basis not of the climate model itself, because that can tell you, but on the basis of an economics model that is linked to the climate model in some way. Right, so we see this, I think it's currently happening, that risk assessment when you build infrastructure. When you build something for 30 years, you want it to be still standing in 30 years. So you know, want to know about flood risk, wildfire risk, these things. So you want very local information. But maybe as a state, you also want information about average temperatures and drought risk and these things. And how do you make the interface between what a climate model outputs, which is basically a large table of these individual model cells and their average temperatures in the summer 30 years hence, or what have you, towards something useful for the economic implementation? And there's a big struggle, and I think this interface is very ill-defined. And at the moment, there's also very little actually taking up information. There's a lot of effort going into producing climate model output. And basically what it's saying is, oh, it's a bad situation, we need to do something about it. So the focus is really on mitigation, and IPCC has been quite successful at pushing certain mitigation aims and enhancing, putting that in the policy. But there are lots of other decisions that are also climate relevant. And I think they are looking for a way of interfacing the hard scientific output, let's say the numbers, to what decision makers can digest. And so I think it's really taking the needs of the model user more into perspective. And their language is just the medium in which we do everything. So that, I mean, that's maybe there's more specific things to be said also.
If I try to reframe what you just said in more theoretical terms, I think it is really, it goes very well with what I was trying to say about kind of the modelers on the one hand, yeah, but also the purpose. And yeah, if you talk about purpose, then there must be a user for mm-hmm. this purpose. So you start identifying stakeholders around yeah. this mm-hmm. modeling, and so it is not in a void,
yeah.
And that's why the vernacular part really, as you said, acquires yeah. Importance. And at the same time, it is not the only thing that is there, but also it is not just that the model says that.
Yeah.
It is us interpreting the result of the model as going in this direction, and if the value behind is mitigation, mm-hmm. then we will exactly. emphasize.
Yeah.
One aspect rather than another. So I like that this gives puts a lot more of responsibility on yeah. the side of mm-hmm. the modelers in how they communicate the interpretation of the results.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for the talk. I was a bit afraid we were going to give the same talk, but this was very different. So that's
good.
Nice. I was wondering, because you talk on the one hand of scientific agency, and
yeah.
as I understood it is, if we are agents as scientists, what we do is modeling. This is
one of the key things we do.
Yes, yeah. yes. But then you talked as well as your notion of mm-hmm. agent, and how is this notion of agent related to a scientific agency for you?
Okay, that's good. Let me try to say something useful there. So if I have a learning agent that does these things, so that learns to flexibly interact with the world in a non-rigid way, that learns to adapt to an environment and does all this based on some intrinsic motivation it has for getting around in the world, what this means specifically depends on the context within which the agent goes about the world, right? So if this is foraging, then we can look at a foraging agent, and it will have a main aim of finding food, and it will learn to adapt to its environment in order to, you know, nourish itself. Whereas if it's a scientific agent, I think the goal is very different, and the question is really, what is the aim of science, right? And there are different answers around. Understanding is probably not very bad, but that tries to, I mean, this puts the episteme thing very high up and tends to disregard the techne. So I think what is really I mean, maybe it sticks out in both directions, right? Sometimes we're more theoretically interested, sometimes we're more interested in getting things done in the world, but what is really central to this effort, no matter which way we go, is to have a tool to interact with the world in a way that is not yet possible for us when we just poke around with our fingers. Because that is not normally science. Sometimes it is, but it is often not enough. And then it becomes interesting, and then we need tools that can be more theoretically structured. Like sometimes we write down an equation, and that can be pure theory, and even the inspiration for writing the equation can be beauty, right? Mathematical beauty. Look at Kepler or something. And sometimes it's really hands-on, very much how can I move an atom in a crystal lattice or something, and then I really want to intervene on something in the world, or I move a cube. I want to move the state of a qubit to a different quantum register or something, and then I'm. But whatever I want to do, I think, if my purpose is as an agent is science, then the model is really key. So it's not food, but it's tools, I would say.
Oh, cool. So actually, and then I go to Sarah. So kind of the basic sense of doing science to you and to Hans is modeling in a way.
I think that comes out in a way, yeah. So it's really much more central than theory, because I think exactly for what the reasons you pointed out, the theory tends to really disregard the materiality of science, which has been there from the very beginning, of course. Yeah.
Super interesting. Okay.
So that was the perfect, you already half answered my question. But my question was about if you could be more explicit on the distinction between how you perceive epistemic agents and scientific agents, exactly for the same reason, and especially also because I really want to try to keep the notion of instruments in my my evaluation of AI systems in science, even though type 1 and type 2 are still learning agents, but I want to call them instruments, whereas I want to highlight the third type in this artificial agency term. So maybe if you could say something more about epistemic and scientific agents, clarify more, because I don't see yet quite the difference so clearly.
Okay, so for me the idea is really the way I want to use scientific agent, at least for this talk, I'm not trying to regiment language, but for this talk, I really want to get at the notion of agency that is exemplified in animals, and not in all animals, so not in bacteria, but in cats. And that is rich enough, right, to to have a substantial notion of learning, where something like individuation takes place, right? An individual agent, through its learning history, can acquire very quirky behavioral dispositions that can maybe only be explained by following the agent through their learning trajectory in interacting with their environment. And when you enter with that loaded notion of agency, you cannot stop here at the level of the physical object, even though the physical object is an epistemic agent in the sense that it's your partner in producing knowledge. I think that this usage of the notion of agency is helpful and is very good, but I want to draw a distinction here, because those epistemic agents are not by themselves learning agents. So I think even if there is some machine learning algorithm running there in a data processing part of CERN's whatever experiment, that is not the agency that is like the agency of a cat. And I think the interesting move from a science assistant, where I think epistemic agent and science assistant, those I would align fairly closely. I think those are notions very much in contact. But an epistemic agent could be a full agent in this sense, or it could just be a physical object, ontologically speaking. Mm-hmm. So I think I can make a distinction, or I would hope to be able to make a distinction in terms of emergence, really, where the question is, has agency gained a foothold in the world with the individual, this specific individual, or not? And that is hopefully a question we can answer more or less objectively. And the notion of things that help us co-produce knowledge is much larger.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I would try to draw the line.
Okay, thank you. It was really nice talk. Now that we entered into the emergence thing, it's perfect.
Okay.
Because I was interested in getting to know a little bit more on your conclusions of this model of the sun.
Yeah.
So, how did you get this emergence? So what is the key thing that for you is jumping from the particles that conform the sun to the structure of the sun? And how would you then relate that to the same emergence in agents?
Mm-hmm.
Because the sun for you is not an agent.
Exactly.
Exactly, yes.
Exactly, yeah.
But then you want to relate these two, no? Like this type of emergence to the type of emergence.
Yeah. So emergence is a loaded word in philosophy and has a difficult history. And it's also used in various ways, many of which I would not want to subscribe to. So we're trying to be somewhat careful in anchoring, in talking only about ontological emergence. There are notions of emergence that are very easy to pin down and completely uncontroversial, right? So, say a system can be such that it's impossible on principle to predict its future state from the state of its individual parts, right? And then you can show that, I don't know, a spin lattice has this emergent property because you cannot compute the resulting magnetization of the spin lattice when it equilibrates from the individual states of the spins, because you can somehow embed the halting problem into this thing, whatever. So that's a solid theoretical result. You can predict what is going to happen, and I think that's not enough. So we wanted to have agency as real in the world, in a sense that it really makes a difference to what the world is like. So at some point there were no agents in the world, and then things happen in the world, and then at some point, you know, there are new objects in the world. And it's the same with stars. So at some point there's a quark gluon plasma, and it's very hot, and processes happen that are like the processes that go on in a star, like deuterium forms and then maybe dissolves or whatever, but those processes do not happen in the right context, and therefore we wouldn't call them fusion processes, for example. So we believe that an ontologically emergent entity is that organizes its matter as material, that has, as it were, a principle of persisting that makes a difference to its underlying material. So this sounds like top-down causation, and in a way it is, right? So we really think that this can only happen in the world when the matter at the lower level, like the elementary particles or my body, right? When they afford possibilities that can, at a higher level, be organized to some aim of the some teleological structure of the overall organization, right? And in the sun, this is the case because you have a lot of processes going on. You have fusion processes going on, and in the sun, these are regulated. So the sun creates, as it were, a certain environment in which the probability of certain collisions is just high enough for the whole thing to be going on for another couple of million years.
Mm-hmm.
And that would not be so if you put the configuration of the same elementary particles in the early universe, because there it would just dissolve and fall apart. Mm-hmm. But when it's a sun, when it's really isolated out there like it is in our solar system, then it has these processes going and it self-regulates in a certain way. So what is important is really an underlying indeterministic matter that affords possibilities that can be structured at a higher level of organization. And this implies unpredictability. So it implies that the higher level cannot be computed from the lower level, but it's more. And the more is that it really adds to the ontology of the world. I mean, this all sounds a bit mushy and crazy, but I think it's really a good way of thinking about organization in nature, that there are certain steps, and there are not too many of them, but some of them are there. Like, maybe a crystal is an example, maybe not. It can be debated, right? It's a solid body. But certainly the cell life and the living body of a mammal, those, I think, are good examples of organized matter, and that still afford possibilities for the organization, and in that sense, choices. Right? So that's how agency really links very nicely with this overall ontological idea. And the sun is like the example that is not so hard to sell, because we don't need to be talking about life and all these things, and certainly not consciousness or thinking mm-hmm. or wanting or what have you, because that's all difficult language, and if you can say something without using it, you're better off, I think.
Very short before we go to Jochen, was this explanation of then organized matter is largely what Helen Stewart says, right?
Well, she says that an agent must be able to settle matters concerning the organization of their bodies. So in that sense, she doesn't talk much about emergent as far as I know.
She does in the end.
Yeah, towards the end. But and for a good reason. I think it's all, you know, this is somehow difficult terrain, because there's also a lot of crazy stuff going on in the emergence discussion. But this idea that the agent's body must afford possibilities for the agent to settle issues about, that is key, and there we completely agree with.
Okay, thanks. Good to know.
Thank you.
My question concerns the notion of trustworthiness.
Yeah.
If I understood you correctly, so on the one hand, we have these difficult models producing output, and on the other hand, we have these decision makers who somehow have to digest this output, but we cannot verify the output in these climate models. And so if I understood you correctly, and maybe that's your point as well, that trustworthiness is now the kind of the bridge that's supposed to gap, the idea that's bridge this gap. If that's true, do you think of trustworthiness as an epistemic or as a psychological notion? So is it that somehow trustworthiness is supposed to give us justification in trusting these models, or is it just give us a good feeling in, I wasn't sure whether it's just a psychological or epistemic thing.
No, thanks. That's a good question. So first, I think I'm in line with Federica when I would object to your first part, where seeing the non-verifiability model as somehow detrimental to the model, because it may really be a wrong way of looking at models, right? So models are always verified or validated or what have you in a certain practice, but in some cases it's very easy when you make a model of free fall and you let your balls roll down your inclined plane and you count, that is the practice of validating that model looks very simple. When you look into what Galileo says he did and what he can possibly have done, again, you see this can't be right. The story is more complicated, because he says he's done it 100 times and it's always been like that. And if he has those data, he has fudged them. So the practice is more difficult. But So I think in a way trustworthiness may always be a part of model validation as a practice. I think because it's, you know, a model is taken up as part of what is learned in a scientific context, what is taught, what people base technology on, what people use to engineer dams and bridges and what have you. So in that sense, trust is key. Now, of course, I would like for trustworthiness to be an epistemic notion, but I find it very hard to spell this out in any precise way. And that's that. So this idea of a trust budget is one attempt of a way in there. So what people do, for example, in climate modeling is you can make many, many model runs, and then you see something about the statistics of your model, and that may give you, you know, error bars on your predictions. But one thing you cannot do, and people in the philosophy of climate science literature are pointing this out, what you cannot do by this technique is to assess your model errors. And you know that you will be making model errors that are systematic and are part of your modeling. So clouds are like the villains in climate modeling, right? Because no one understands them. And basically all the uncertainty about climate modeling is through the handling of clouds in the various systems. And it's a complete mess. And can you find a way of assessing your model error? It seems like that must be impossible, right? Because when your model is wrong, it's just wrong. And then you can't use it. But there are techniques for approximating modeling in a way that makes it amenable to statistical analysis, and where you can then say, I have a justified assessment of my modeling error, not just of the statistical error on my predictions, but really on the insecurity with regard to the model I'm using. You will never be able to do that if you try to model for like 100,000 years, but within this 100-year time frame that is really of the essence of current climate modeling, you may be in a not so bad position to even do that. And then maybe you can stick together, you know, a notion of overall trustworthiness that has some quantifiable aspects as well. And then you might want to hope that this gives you, you know, an epistemic notion of trustworthiness.
But this is then not so closely related to the interactive stuff you talked about in your presentation.
Exactly, because the users of the model, ideally, you would make this interactive interface such that when the model scores well on the epistemic notions of trustworthiness, the feel of the model will be one of trustworthiness. And I think we have instances where this happens, right? With weather apps, you know when to look at the Swiss and when to look at the German or whatever. And you always look at the Swiss because they're better. But so in this sense, I think you can maybe align it. But phenomenologically, they are completely different. And you can sell bullshit to the public. We know this, right? You can also sell distrust. And it's an industry. And it's well-paid jobs there, right? So in that sense, obviously, it doesn't align, but it might, hopefully.